Are you recording for me? Yes, thank you. Well, good morning, everyone. I was really hoping to be speaking to you from Blue Mountain Zendo this morning, but I am not. I am speaking to you from a hotel room outside Bellingham Airport because I was turned away from the border because my COVID test was 5 hours expired. Along with quite a few other people, reputed the one person reputed to have been turned away for 5 minutes, the COVID test being 5 minutes expired. So here I am. It's part of the great adventure of traveling in these times. I got my latest COVID test back from a little tent outside, and I'll be coming home, meeting Michael at the border very soon. So this has had me reflecting a lot on how we who live in the dominant cultures of the most economically developed countries of the world, how we take for granted a freedom of mobility unprecedented in history. We are very far from the mentality of those who spent their entire lives in one small town or in a valley between mountains, rarely crossing that mountain pass into the next valley where people might speak with a different language or different accent. Apparently, Papua New Guinea, has anyone ever read the figures of how many? It's very convoluted topography, and apparently there's just hundreds of languages. Each mountain valley has a different language. And so different language, different ways of eating and cooking, different ways of organizing family life. All the incredible diversity of human life on this planet has begun to blur in our times. And we can step out of any airport and not be quite sure where we are and see the same fast food outlets in any airport, almost. Vancouver Airport still has the best art anywhere. Art from Canada's, the First Nations of Canada, what we call Canada. So most of us don't take kindly to having our freedom of mobility restricted. And I must admit, I've had my share of frustration over these weeks. But particularly this past year, during the year, more than a year of the pandemic, whether it's a trip to Mexico that you had been counting on or simply crossing town to have dinner with friends or family. So yes, I've been reflecting on impermanence and interconnection when it comes to the movement of human beings, plants, and animals across the earth over time, and all the different ways that has happened and the consequences of those movements. Some of you may have noticed that at the very end of the May Mountain Rain newsletter, I put a photo of a bee gathering nectar from a shrub with white flowers. And in the caption, I asked, can you identify this shrub? And so I want to thank Susu, Barbara, and Rich for replying and to congratulate them on coming close, but not exactly. All identified the shrub as a wild honeysuckle. And Susu came the closest with Bell's honeysuckle, which turns out, I did not know this, which turns out to be an invasive species with pink flowers, and the one I pictured, the one which I saw all around with white flowers, is an Amur honeysuckle, Lonicera maki, another invasive species native to China, Japan, Korea, and the Russian Far East. And its highly invasive nature was quite evident to me in the woodlands where I walked daily in Pennsylvania. For anyone who doesn't know where I was, where I was visiting family in the eastern states, these were the mixed hardwood forests of my childhood. I spent hours in these woods as a child, with towering oaks and maples and tulip poplars, and the trails lined with delicate wildflowers, the air filled with birdsong. These walks, as I think some of you know, were particularly meaningful to me because I could imagine my mother coming along with me and commenting on what we heard and saw, pausing to hone in on an unusual bird song and look up high in the trees with binoculars to spot a really unusual warbler high in the canopy. Oops, somebody's not muted.
I took care of it now.
Thank you. Yeah, my mom taught me the names of those birds and flowers as soon as I was old enough to toddle outside. And as many of you know, my mom died just a year ago at the age of 96. So the day after I arrived was the anniversary. And I took a walk in her honor in a wildflower preserve that she used to love to go to. It was really... Quite beautiful to do that. But these shrubby honeysuckle bushes with the white flowers were not in the woods of my childhood. So as I read more about them, I discovered that they were more recently introduced, and they spread rapidly, and they crowd out. I mean, they make a pretty bush. They were introduced as an ornamental, but they crowd out native shrubs and understory plants. And it turns out their berries are not as nutritious as those of the native shrubs. And that although many birds nest in them, and I observed birds nesting in them, I heard baby birds, there were a lot of wrens, that the survival rate from that nesting is lower. And the researchers speculate that it's because these invasive honeysuckles leaf out early and birds nest in them before the upper leaves have come out, so that nest predators like crows and small hawks can get access more easily. Amazing how complex the relationships, the interrelationships of the ecosystems are. So at first I thought that the fragrant viney honeysuckle that I remember from my childhood was native. I remembered my rambles through old overgrown meadow, and in the corner was an old neglected orchard. And the honeysuckle vines grew all over the old apple trees and created little bowers, little rooms where the deer had bedded down and flattened the grasses. And I would go in there and curl up and pretend I was a deer. And for those of you who may have grown up with that kind of honeysuckle, you might remember how you could pick a blossom and then just snip off the base and pull out the stamens, and a little drop of nectar would come out, and you could taste the nectar. Did anybody do that? Yeah, some of you did. So it was a shock for me to discover that honeysuckle, too, is an invasive. It's called Lonicera japonica, native to East Asia, introduced to Long Island, New York in 1810 as an ornamental. According to, there's a really comprehensive website called invasive.org, which gives, you know, an amazing wealth of information about all kinds of invasive species. And apparently this honeysuckle invades a wide variety of habitats, forest floors, canopies, roadsides, wetlands, and disturbed areas. Because it's a vine, it can girdle and kill small saplings twining around them, and it can form dense mats in the canopies of trees, just as I observed in the old apple orchard as a child. So this realization, as I said, came as something of a shock, a little bit, and I do mean a little bit, like finding out that your dear grandfather was a war criminal or a residential school teacher. But as we'll see as we go along, as I go along in this talk, we have to be very careful about applying human values and metaphors to the natural world. We hear a lot about invasive species. The Asian giant hornet. Has anyone seen one yet? I don't know if they've arrived. Yeah, they were first sighted in December of 2019 on Vancouver Island. But I didn't check to see how far they've spread. And then, of course, the Norway rat, which didn't or originate in Norway, but is believed to have come from China along the Silk Road as far as Persia, and then in 200 years made it from Persia to England. And then, along with European expansion around the world, it spread throughout the world. Certainly, plants and animals have spread around the world over land and water through gradual means since life's beginnings, slowly adapting to new and changing environments through complex evolutionary and ecological processes, with species hybridizing and merging and also splitting into new species and some dying out, even through mass extinctions, as you know. And yet the amazing diversity of life has ways of reasserting itself over and over again. But the movements of us, human beings, have resulted in the spread of other plant and animal species at increasingly rapid rates and quantities as our human mobility has increased, you know, particularly in the last two centuries, even more so since, you know, at the second half of the 20th century, with often devastating results to native species and ecologies. So what is an invasive species? The World Wildlife Federation defines invasive species as any kind of living organism, an amphibian like the cane toad in Australia, plant, insect, fish, fungus, bacteria, or even an organism's seeds or eggs that is not native to an ecosystem and causes harm. They can harm the environment, the economy, human health, or the health of other beings, other species. Some have been introduced intentionally by us humans for various purposes, ornamental, food, erosion control, even pest control, without our full understanding of the complicated ecological relationships within which that species lived in its native environment and the effects of placing it in a completely new environment. Other invasive species arrive as unintentional results of human activity, primarily trade. Many, many marine invasive species are spread in ship's ballast, which is loaded up in one place and then emptied out in another place. We might argue that human beings ourselves are the most invasive species on Earth and the greatest spreader of invasive species. But it's good to remember that most introduced species do not become invasive. Many do not thrive. Some adapt. Some die out without serious consequences to the local ecosystem. So it's a minority of introduced species or migrant species that become harmful. Now, I want to point out that I'm not using the word alien, which is sometimes used, and that's because I believe there is no living thing that is alien to this earth. Sometimes the language of enmity and warfare is used to discuss combating invasive species and the methods slash burn and poison certainly resonate with the warfare metaphor. It's also used for fighting cancer slash burn and poison, right? Methods that are used when we don't fully understand the complex workings of the world. Some methods end up backfiring and doing more harm than good, or creating new ecological problems. So there are those researchers and people who are doing habitat restoration work who are using a more ecological approach, trying to look with more complexity, recognizing that it's often ailing or disturbed ecosystems that are more vulnerable to invasive species. So what are the underlying conditions? If we apply a Buddhist perspective, we might suggest that it's not a matter of good or evil species, but of right relationship, of context, of balance. It would be all too easy to equate invasive species with colonizing human beings. And certainly the damaging effects on native peoples, plant and animal communities of human colonization have often been devastating. But as I've said, plant, animal, and human movement has been occurring for ages, ages past. And human groups have been mixing their genes for as long as there have been humans, sometimes through trade and travel between tribes and groups, sometimes through invasion and conquering others through violent means. Human greed, hatred, and ignorance, as we know, have long, deep roots. And human efforts at peacemaking, at living peaceably together, also have long, deep roots. And every human religion or set of spiritual practices includes ways of supporting us to live in harmony with each other and with other beings. Hopefully, with other beings. Greed and hatred are easier to observe in our collective human behavior, but ignorance is a little harder to observe. I think ignorance, in Buddhist terms, means that we don't see the truth of impermanence. We don't see the truth of non-separate self-nature. That we don't see the intricate interconnections and consequences of our self-centered actions. And by self-centered, I mean individual and collective. Me and mine, us and ours, as opposed to you and yours, them and theirs. All too often, our efforts to live harmoniously together extend only as far as our in-group. And so we have people coming on ships from Europe to North America, fleeing starvation, religious persecution, or seeking their fortune, or new food sources, or more fertile land, just as humans have spread all over the world throughout history. You know, we're even spreading into Antarctica. And what are we looking for there? Knowledge, some would claim more resources to mine. The Europeans brought with them seeds and animals, beliefs and customs, and they found people already living here in North America, South America, Central America, people already living in this seemingly wild new land, people with their own knowledge of plant and animal life, their own beliefs and customs. And like so many societies, the Europeans saw the others as strange, different, threatening, inferior, saw their own way of life as God-ordained and best. And they claimed this land in the name of their rulers and their God. There were those few who were curious, who were interested in learning the ways and knowledge of the indigenous peoples and this new land, but most were intent on surviving and bending the land to their needs. The indigenous people of this land had deep and detailed knowledge of their environment, but they had never been exposed to the disease organisms carried by the Europeans, nor did they have the technology to produce steel and the weaponry of firearms. And these two factors, as well as the beliefs and customs of the newcomers, led to the decimation and displacement of many of the Eastern First Nations. But as settlement encroached further and further west, the Europeans encountered strong resistance from the peoples there. And a strategy of control was devised to remove children from their family, often forcibly, and put them in residential schools to, as it was said, take the Indian out of them. And they were punished for speaking their own language, and they were taught to conform to the ways of European culture. These schools, as you know, were run by religious organizations, many Catholic, but also many Protestant. And the abuses of children in these schools have become well known through the testimony of survivors. The beatings, malnutrition, psychological and sexual abuse. Many suffered the effects of trauma for years into adulthood, passing the legacy on to their children and grandchildren. Others died at the schools, including the 215 children whose remains were found on the grounds of the largest residential school in Canada in Kamloops, just recently. This discovery, as you know, has stunned and shaken First Nations communities, and the entire nation. It's also reverberated internationally. Just last week, I listened to an interview on PBS, the U.S. Public Radio, with an American Native rights activist who is expressing hope that this discovery would spur efforts towards full acknowledgement of and reparations for residential school abuses in the States, where there have been no such measures, no such full acknowledgement or reparation. And she was actually looking towards Canada as a model. Ouch. She was looking at Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission and reparations that have been made. So you don't need me to tell you more about this. You can find more information and inform yourself about this history through journalism, fiction, personal accounts by First Nation authors, and listening to the voices of those speaking out now. You can support First Nations actions for human rights and climate justice. You can learn about the plants and animals that are native to this region and what relationship First Peoples had to them, what knowledge they have still and are teaching still. The elders are still teaching this knowledge. So I've been taking a roundabout approach to say that we must be wary of applying constructs of species movement and adaptation, invasion and extinction to human behavior. It can be too easy to rationalize in the way that social Darwinism did, that concept that human groups are subject to the Darwinist laws of evolution. You know, the survival of the fittest was used to justify imperialism, the very mindset that created residential schools. We have to be wary also of using Buddhist perspectives of impermanence or the absolute oneness, non-differentiation, as a way of distancing ourselves from the harms done, the specificity of harms done in our name. We humans have the capacity to do great wrong out of greed, hatred, and delusion. And we also have the capacity to see deeply into the roots of the suffering that we cause ourselves and others, to see the forest and the trees, to see complexity, to see the vast net of interconnections within which we live, and to honor them all, to appreciate the vastness of what we don't understand, to open our senses, our minds, and our hearts to learn, to listen to other beings, human beings who are different from us, to the plants and animals and earth systems upon which our very lives depend. Rather than labeling other humans or other species as good or bad, this or that, we can look at right relationship, at balance, at restoring relationship. We can't turn back the clock, but we can look at right relationship. And when we see that harm has been done, whether by our blood ancestors or not, we are part of this collective entity we call Canada. And as such, we can fully avow harm done, and make reparation to the extent possible, and make restoration of right relationship to the extent possible. I've come to feel that this deep seeing and taking of responsibility is so urgent in so many ways, in so many parts of the world. You know, I feel this as I spend time in my land of my birth and childhood, and the great deep pain of race relationship here. I've come to feel that this deep seeing and taking of responsibility is key to our very survival as a species and the well-being of other species on this earth. It depends on every single one of us and how we respond individually and together. So that concludes what I wanted to talk about today. And I am so grateful that this whole month that I've been away, that I've been able to continue practicing with all of you. I've missed the early morning sits because I miss all of you who sit at 7 in the morning, because that's the time when I'm usually getting out in the woods or on my way to visit my dad. So I look forward to rejoining the morning zazen, and continuing to practice with all of you. Your presence and practice has meant so much and supported me in my month away. So let's chant together. Oh, and I will say, in the service today, I'm going to bow out so that I can make sure to get a taxi to the border. And our service today will be dedicated to those children.